Good morning, everybody. I guess one thing I've realized already this morning, that if you're scheduled to preach with me, come prepared without a PowerPoint. This is the second time in a row that our PowerPoint projector has kind of given us problems when I've been slated to preach. So be fairly warned that you might not have it, so you can use the old chalkboard like I kind of did last time. So obviously, by looking at the screen, I'm talking about a topic that's kind of pretty related and important to myself because of what I do for a living. And that's the idea that I'm a Christian and a scientist. At first, I was going to put on the slide being a Christian scientist, but that's actually a whole other religion, and that wouldn't have made any sense and would have been misleading, so I had to change up how I worded this a little bit. And so, as most of you know, science is at odds with religion pretty severely. It seems to be getting worse and worse now that anytime you see, and especially with the media, they portray some discovery that science has shown that, you know, religion is irrelevant. And so me, being a Christian and obviously being religious, how can I justify being a scientist as a profession? So I'm going to share with you guys how I go about doing that. So the first thing to realize is that science isn't inherently evil. The slide's not up here just so I have the crazy mad scientist guy. This sometimes is what I look like while I'm working. For the most part, though, I stay composed. But there are some professions in this world that are inherently evil. And of course, if science is one of those, I, as a Christian, couldn't do that. Some of the examples I have are abortion doctors, prostitutes, drug dealers. They're jobs that what you do is sinful in and of itself. So the abortion doctors, murder, prostitutes, it's all about sexual immorality. Drug dealers, at the very least, you're helping someone stay addicted to something. At the very worst, you're one of the like South American drug lords that are responsible for all sorts of murder and everything else. So those are professions that are evil in and of themselves. Understand, though, that each job does come with inherent risk that could lead to sin. For example, bankers, you're dealing with money all the time. You have access to it. Greed, covetousness could slowly creep up into your life. Politicians, most of us think politicians are evil, and to be a politician, you have to be evil, but that's not the case. You can be a religious politician and be a good politician, but of course, you're susceptible to bribery, corruption, things like that. Doctors, they get sucked into working really, really long hours, and they neglect their families. Lawyers kind of go to the politicians category. Sometimes we think they're all evil, but I'm sure we know at least one good lawyer in this world. And one reason this is important, because we as Christians, we are commanded to work. And so I am supposed to have a job, and I'm supposed to have a job that fits in line with a Christian lifestyle or a Christian life. So Ephesians chapter 4, verse 28. Ephesians 4, 28. Let him who stole steal no longer. So going back to the jobs, I guess thief would be of those inherently evil professions. So if you're a thief, don't do that anymore. Let him who stole steal no longer, but rather let him labor, working with his hands. What is good, that he may have something to give him who has in need, or who is in need. So working his hands, what is good? So that falls down into this category of those jobs. Jobs that are themselves good, that you can legitimately make money with as a Christian. Another verse is 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, verse 11. 'That you also aspire to lead a quiet life, to mind your own business, and to work with your own hands as we commanded you.' And then just one more to bring home the point that we are commanded to work as Christians. 2 Corinthians chapter 3, verse 12. 'Now those who are such we command and exhort through our Lord Jesus Christ that they work in quietness and eat their own bread.' So I am commanded to work, and since science in and of itself is not evil, it's a job I can have, and so it's a job I choose to have. So I don't think there's too many problems with that one. However, just to get it out of the way, I am a biologist, and so of course with biology comes the topic of evolution. And this is one that people, they ask me all the time, how do I deal with evolution? How do I handle evolution? It surrounds me. That is, admittedly, it's not easy. I work in a job that I am surrounded by this. First thing to realize is that science doesn't necessarily equal evolution. I'm a scientist, but I don't deal with evolution at all, ever. It's just something I don't do. I work to see how the brain works. I don't care about evolution. I don't deal with evolution. That being said, there are fields of science that do deal directly with evolution. And so I don't think, as a Christian, I could work in one of those fields and be comfortable. Maybe others can. I'm not sure. But the best way, at least as far as I'm concerned, to deal with the evolution aspect of science is to be understanding. All the people I work with, not all of them, a vast majority of them do believe in evolution. And the reason that is they don't want to believe in God. They don't want to do that. They won't say that out loud, but ultimately they don't want to believe that they are subject to a creator. And so they have to fill that void. They got here somehow, and there has to be something that got them from nothing to where we are now. Evolution fills that void. And we have to understand that that's something they need. If you take that from them, they have almost nothing. And so you have to be understanding about that. Another thing you have to be understanding with evolution is we don't have all the answers either. The Bible is not a book of science. It doesn't pretend to be. And there are just some things we have to say we don't know to. One thing that it doesn't trouble me, but it always makes me think, is how has something always existed? God has always existed. That boggles my mind. He always will exist. Evolution takes the similar approach to stuff. Something has always had to exist for there to have been the Big Bang. So both sides, we argue that there's always been something, but there's really no way to answer how that is possible. It's just, I don't know if anyone has a suggestion, I'd be glad to hear, but I have no idea how it happens. So you have to recognize there are some answers that we don't have either. And so when you see these individuals and you're dealing with these individuals, you have to be understanding. This next one's a little different, and I didn't realize this until this year, but I'm in a philosophy class, and when you're actually in a philosophy class with a bunch of people who believe in evolution and they live their lives according to those laws, supposedly, you realize that their evolutionary theory and the morality that they argue doesn't quite equal up. It's been months now, but in the past I did a sermon on morality and how it had to have come from somewhere. Someone gave us that morality. And so the verse I pulled up here was Proverbs 26:5, which is one of my favorite verses. It's how you answer a fool according to his folly. And in this case, the folly is if we have evolved and we are just pretty much creatures of primal instincts and we do what we need to survive, then the logic that a lot of them hold to of all the good and stuff that goes on in the world just doesn't hold up, because we wouldn't have evolved like that if we were sticking strictly to their definitions of how we are supposed to advance and move along. So this philosophy class I'm taking right now, which, if you're a philosopher, I guess good for you. It's an interesting class. I don't know how much worth there is in it. We talk a lot, and a lot of times we ultimately just don't end up with any answers on anything because they don't have a concrete foundation to base any of their arguments on. It's your argument is just as good as my argument because there is no absolute we have to adhere to. Don't worry. I get into more scriptures a little later on, so I'm just going through these. This is one that is kind of difficult because we all have very strong opinions on lots of things. But as far as being a Christian goes, I'm starting out kind of behind the eight ball when it comes to talking with these people. We already disagree on one fundamental aspect of life. And so it's best, I've found, that I don't get caught up in all these what I call non-issues. These are issues that don't really pertain to their salvation or our salvation whatsoever. Global warming, if the world's really warming up or not, and if man is causing it or not, I may have an opinion on it, but if that's going to make them not want to talk to me, then I don't need to have an opinion on it. Because honestly, if the world is warming up and men are causing it, that's not going to affect whether or not I go to heaven or not. Gun control is another pretty contentious issue. With just what happened in Paris, I'm sure it's going to come up again. It comes up, seems to be, all the time now. Healthcare, if it's universal or not, it doesn't really matter all that much. The tax code, environmentalism, all these issues that people take really hard stands on and will get angry over at people if they disagree with them is stuff that I need to stay away from, especially because I don't want to do anything to lessen my influence on them. I have a couple verses about that. 2 Timothy chapter 2, verses 23 through 24. But avoid foolish and ignorant disputes, knowing that they generate strife. And a servant of the Lord must not quarrel, but be gentle to all, able to teach, patient. This is talking about, I think, mainly disputes and whatnot in the church, but it applies here as well, that foolish and ignorant disputes, these won't advance the cause of Christ at all, and so I need to avoid them, which is, it can be difficult at times. Titus chapter 3, verses 1 through 2. Remind them to be subject to rulers and authorities, to obey, to be ready for every good work, to speak evil of no one, to be peaceable, gentle, showing humility to all men. It's hard to stay peaceable when talking to some people about these topics. That's admittedly, there are people with very strong and sometimes ignorant positions, but it's hard to be peaceable with people like that. So just, I have to avoid talking about that thing, those things. And my influence can win people, and so I shouldn't destroy it, because as a Christian in a science field, my influence is pretty precious, because I think there's one song that we sing sometimes, the world has no other Bible or something like that, but the people that see us as Christians, I murdered the way the song goes, but it's roughly that's the idea, and it's very true with a lot of the people I interact with. They won't go and crack their own Bible open. They have their own opinion of Christians created in their mind, and so when they see me, they project that image on me, and I have to either combat that image or live up to the almost impossible image standard they have for Christians. But so 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 12. Having your conduct honorable among the Gentiles, that when they speak against you as evildoers, they may, by your good works, which they observe, glorify God in the day of visitation. So our influence is super important, and I don't need to do anything, including arguing about frivolous issues that will hurt that influence. One of the most important things, even outside of not arguing with people about seemingly big topics, is to stay patient. A lot of the times, if you go and engage some of these people in the conversation about religion, that's done. It's a non-starter. You just might as well have not even said anything to them all. And they won't listen to you the rest of your life. So how do you start a conversation with someone who hates the idea of religion? And you have to wait for them to bring it up. I have a friend who, wife, I guess she's back there. But I have a friend, she's a girl, we're pretty good friends. We came into the grad school program at the same time. And she's pretty staunchly anti-religious. She is. And the most fascinating thing happened is about a year ago, we were in the car going somewhere, and she just starts to get in kind of this deep thought conversation mode, and all of a sudden she kind of asks, well, what if there's more out there? Well, there's your in. If I'd have started 2 years prior when I first met her trying to convince her to come to church and to become a Christian, that conversation never would have happened. And so just staying patient with her and being a friend to her for years and years opened up the door to a conversation that I never in a million years thought I would have had with this person. And so a couple ideas about patience. 2 Timothy chapter 2, verse 24 through 25. We've already kind of hit on this verse. So we've already read verse 24, but I'll start there again. And a servant of the Lord must not quarrel, but be gentle to all, able to teach, patient, in humility, correcting those who are in opposition, if God perhaps will grant them repentance so that they may know the truth. And another thing about the staying patient is kind of the flip side of that is I'm exposed a lot of times to people making jokes about religion. It's, I don't know, a job hazard, I suppose. And kind of outburst of wrath or outburst of anger or getting mad at them, actually, it won't do anything. It goes back to the influence verse from the previous slide, that if they just see me acting out and being angry, well, they're like, oh, well, look at the guy being a Christian again. And so I have to stay patient in that way to keeping my anger under control. So Proverbs chapter 29, verse 11, I don't know if anger is the right word, annoyance, I suppose, either way. Chapter 29, verse 11. A fool vents all his feelings, but a wise man holds them back. And so There are times when you just have to sit there. You don't have to grin and bear it. You can just bear it. But yelling out at them, being mean to them, isn't going to help anything. James chapter 1, verse 19 through 20. So then, my beloved brethren, let every man be swift to hear, slow to speak, slow to wrath, for the wrath of a man does not produce the righteousness of God. And so finally, this is true, well, most of these things have been true in regard of anywhere you work and wherever, whatever you do, is the most important thing I'd say working in my field and being a Christian and a scientist is staying humble. In my field, self-promotion, it's a desired quality. You promote your papers. There's not a lot of money being thrown around for scientific funding, and so the limited money that there is there, if you can promote yourself to get that money, you look better, you have a job. Let's see, I forget who the name is. But anyway, you make a big, big discovery. The entire community essentially worships you for a certain amount of time until somebody makes another big discovery. And so it's really easy to be overtaken by conceit in this profession. It's really easy. And so humility is a very important quality to hold. Another thing about humility is that when I'm not around my science friends and my science coworkers, is that ridicule advances no one's cause. Sometimes when we get into our Christian cohorts and our Christian groups, they make fun of us in their groups. We'll kind of make fun of scientists over in our own little groups too. But just because they're ridiculing us doesn't really mean we should be ridiculing them back. So Ephesians chapter 4, verse 29. Let no corrupt word proceed out of your mouth, but what is good for necessary edification, that it may impart grace to the hearers. When we're ridiculing other people, regardless of the reason, we are not imparting grace upon our fellow hearers. James chapter 3, verses 9 through 10. With it, talking about our mouth in this instance, that's what the "it" is. So with it we bless our God and Father, and with it we curse men, who have been made in the similitude of God, or some versions say the likeness of God or image of God. Out of the same mouth proceed blessing and cursing. My brethren, these things ought not to be so. We can't come in here and worship God and bless our friends, bless our neighbors, say prayers, while at the same time we're ridiculing others. It ought not be so. Our humility, our attitude, being humble, it completely dictates how we treat others. Philippians chapter 2, verses 4 through 7. Let each of you look out not only for his own interest, but also the interest of others. Let this mind be in you, which was also in Christ Jesus, who being in the form of God did not consider it robbery to be equal with God, but made himself of no reputation, taking the form of a bondservant and coming in the likeness of men. And so a humble attitude, because chapter 2 starts talking about humility, and so I started a few verses in, but it completely dictates how we as Christians act. It's how we run our lives. I think humility is almost the quintessential Christian trait. If you could describe how to be a Christian in one word, humility would probably be a very good one to throw out there. You could say Christ-like, but being Christ-like would include you being absolutely humble. He came to earth, which was an act of humility in itself, and then he went ahead and died for us, which is, again, it's just, his humility compounds upon itself, and just it's nothing we could ever achieve. But he's the perfect example, and it's an example for us and a reminder of us that whatever we do in our lives, we have to stay humble. It's a hard thing to do, especially, I don't know if it's harder in America than in other countries. America, I wouldn't say, is a very humble place to live. But humility is, it's essential to being a Christian. And with that, and my last point, Colossians chapter 3, verses 12 through 14, is that humility is a trait of God's chosen ones. Therefore, as the elect of God, Christians, holy and beloved, put on tender mercies, kindness, humility, meekness, long-suffering, bearing with one another and forgiving one another. If anyone has a complaint against another, even as Christ forgave you, so you also must do. But above all these things, put on love, which is the bond of perfection. And Paul, as he's speaking to us there, he commands us directly as Christians that humility is a trait we must have. And so that was just a short little lesson about how I, as a Christian, go about living every day in my little world of science. Fortunately, I work in the lab by myself most of the time, and so there's not too many interactions that will cause any strife or problems. But going around Bible thumping is not always the best approach. And so this is how I approach it. I hope you learned a little bit, and maybe you can take some of these ideas into whatever you do for your own job. And so with the idea of humility, I want to offer the invitation to anyone who isn't a Christian this morning. It's not easy to come forward and to say that I am unworthy, I'm a sinner, I need help, but it's the first step into being humble. And if there are any Christians here already who need to come back to Christ, who have for some reason fallen away or needs the prayers of the congregation for any reason, we ask that you come forward now as we stand and as we sing.